I'm Larry Morrow, and this is Take Two, the radio program that looks inside a person's adventure, not so much from the outside in, but the inside out. In the next 30 minutes, you will discover the inward joy of their heart that married them to the passion of their life and the affirmation of the ideals that directed their success. You're in for a treat today. Very so often, you meet people along the way that resonate joy, success, inspiration, and sadness, of which I will touch on all of them today with my very special guest, Mike Swiger. Mike is a pastor, an award-winning author, teacher, and executive director of True Freedom Ministries. And Mike's life, to put it mildly, is an incredible story of God's redemption. Mike Swiger has a heart for those living on the fringes of society. So let's explore all of those. Hello, my friend. Mike, how are you?
I'm good, Larry. How are you today?
I am well. Thank you. Mike, over the past few years, I have had the immense pleasure of knowing you and spending hours upon hours interviewing you and your associates. But let's get to the story that most people don't know with my special guest. You were born and raised in Wheeling, West Virginia. What is it you remember most about those early days before coming to Cleveland, Mike?
The geography. The Ohio River was my backyard, and the Appalachian Mountains come down and touch the river right there. So it's a very beautiful area, beautiful part of the country. The other part of it that I always remember from my growing up is there's a 5-mile stretch where we have five Hall of Fame athletes are from. Lou Groza grew up 2 miles from me. Bill Mazeroski's from my hometown. Joe and Phil Negro are from the next town down, and Johnny Havlicek is from the next town down. So I grew up in a very big hotbed of professional athletes.
See, you didn't know then that your name was going to come right at the end of those, did you?
I did not.
No, you did not. And then all of a sudden you come to Cleveland. What year was that? And how old were you, Mike, when you came to Cleveland?
I was 18 years old in 1986. I came to Cleveland to attend college at Case Western University.
And that has turned out to be an incredible move. We all know that. All right. Now, so, Mike, there's a story associated with something that changed your life. Your brother has asked you to arrange a meeting with a friend, and let's take it from there.
Yeah, I was a sophomore at college. I got a phone call from my brother in the middle of the night, stating that his former college roommate had gotten in some trouble, was going to implicate him in the trouble, and wanted to know if I would arrange a meeting so my brother could meet with him in Hudson, Ohio, to talk about this issue. And actually, my brother was going to bribe him not to testify against him or even mention his name in the investigation. That took place on Father's Day weekend in 1988.
So then what happened? You're taking me through part of the story. Then what happened?
Yeah, I picked up my brother, drove him to the location we had decided. I dropped him off, left, parked the car. I came back in the middle of my brother savagely beating up his friend. I ran and got the car to come back. And when I got back, his friend was dead. He beat him to death right in the park, sunny day around noon on June 17th, 1988. And that's a devastating thing to see. People see it all the time on TV and movies. Someone will get killed, and then people walk away with a snappy saying. That's not how it is in real life. It's devastating when you see something like that.
Well, Mike, that turned out to be a cataclysmic calamity that forever has altered your life. So now you're driving home following that event. Then what happens?
So within a matter of hours, I think maybe within 24 hours, I got a call from the local police, and I was questioned the following Monday. I lied to the police. I was questioned several more times about the events of that weekend that I lied about. Each time when they called, they offered me immunity if I would cooperate, if I would give them any information. And every time I chose to lie to protect my brother.
Then what happened?
So it was hard to carry this secret around. You know, I started drinking very heavily. I started failing in school. I was struggling. I was a co-op engineer for a company I worked for in Cleveland, and I was doing poorly at that. My life was just falling apart. I was driving home from work on October 5th, 1989, a year later, and I was driving into my driveway, and I was met by about 25 police officers who were waiting to arrest me. And I was handcuffed. I was jammed in the back of a police car. And the first thing I felt was an immediate sense of relief that the lie was over. My house of cards had collapsed. And then terror because I knew this was going to be a sensational case. You know, I was a student at Case Western. My brother was a law student at Temple. My father was in his fourth term as county commissioner, and I knew it was going to make big news. And it did. We were on the front page of the Washington Post, New York Times. We were on the Plain Dealer dozens of times on the front page, Beacon Journal dozens of times. They ended up making a movie out of the case. So being a high-profile defendant is not the way to go through the criminal justice system.
Mm-hmm. Now, Mike, while in prison, this sounds like Shawshank Redemption all over again. While in prison, you earned two associate degrees with a 4-point GP. Then you went on to graduate summa cum laude from Ohio University with a bachelor's degree in business administration, then on to a full scholarship to study theology at the Reform Theology Seminar. Now, this to me is almost an impossible story. How do you go to prison? You were there for 17 years, and I would like to take it almost from the time that you thought you were going to be there for only 5 years. Mike, walk us through that time that you thought, well, I'm going to be here for 5 to 7 years, then I'm going to get out.
I did. I went in believing that I would not do more than a couple years. That mm-hmm. was just my mindset. In fact, I had an opportunity to come home from prison within the first 3 years, actually. We filed a motion called Super Shock Probation, and it's a very narrow qualification. You had to be a first-time, nonviolent, non-principal offender, so you had to be a co-defendant like I was. So we filed the motion with my sentencing judge, and my motion was granted. I was supposed to be released on September 1st, 1993. So I had sent all my stuff home from prison. I kept that very quiet because good news for you doesn't mean good news for anybody else. And sometimes mm-hmm. guys in prison kind of act savagely towards guys who get good news. So I was keeping that quietly. And the day before I was supposed to be released, I get a knock on my cell door, and it's a guy from the cell next to me. And he said, "Do you have something pending in court?" And I said, "I do." He said, "I just heard on the radio it was denied." And I said, "That can't be. I have my discharge papers in my hand." So I went and called my lawyer. And the lawyer said, "I don't know what to tell you. The prosecution didn't oppose us, but the judge overturned her own decision. Your next chance to come home is 10 more years.
10 more years.
Yeah.
Like, how did that hit you at that point in time?
It was utterly devastating. I had to call my mom to say, "Don't come get me tomorrow. It's going to be another decade." You know, I was a believer at that time. And when this news hit, I was mad at God. I felt the system was unfair. And I really just wanted to wallow in my own despair. And it was a moment of crisis for me. And at that moment, I had trained myself to read the Bible every day. Mm-hmm. And I picked up the Bible. My daily devotional for that day was from the Daily Bread. And it was on James chapter 1, verses 2 through 12, which says, mm-hmm. "Count it all joy, my brothers, when you face fiery trials, for the trying of your faith works patience." And I didn't want patience. I wanted to go home. But I really felt like God spoke to my heart and said, "Well, you want to get involved in prison ministry? Why not be a prison missionary? You're already here." At that time, I was working in the warden's office. I was a warden's clerk. I had been there for 3 years. I had the best job in the prison. And I quit my job to go be a janitor in a chapel. And I found a great deal of peace being right where God would have me to be.
You know, that's the part that sounds like Shawshank Redemption. The moment you mentioned I was friends with the warden, spent 3 years working for the warden. Mike, and then wasn't there a time then when you thought you were going to get out that it happened all over again?
Yes.
You've been there how long now?
The second time that happened, I had been in prison for 8 years. My lawyer came to see me. I had not spoken to him in 4 years, and he said the Ohio Supreme Court had just overturned a case just like mine, and that if I wanted to file an appeal, a delayed appeal, he thought I would get a new trial. So he filed the motion, and I prayed about it. And at that same time, I had been applying to seminaries, and my prayer to God was, "Lord, if you want me to go to seminary to get involved in ministry, you have to do two things. Deny this appeal, because if I come home, I'm not going to do this. I need to get a job, I need to get married. And then I also needed $30,000 to go to graduate school. And I was making $17 a month. So I knew if I was going to go to a seminary to go to graduate school, God was going to pay for it. Well, in the meantime, I decided to write the great American novel. I was going to write a pro-life Christian murder mystery about two brothers. Yes, you did. Write what you know. So that's what I did. And I write this manuscript. I send it off to an agent. I get a letter back saying, "Great plot. Terrible writing. It's as if you have no training whatsoever." So I started teaching myself how to write. And I rewrote the manuscript on an electric typewriter, no memory, no computer, sent it off to another publisher. And same thing. So over the course of the next 3 years, I rewrote this manuscript 6 times from scratch, but ultimately I was offered a 2-book deal. So back to 1997. So the first week of May rolled around, I got a letter from my lawyer who said the Supreme Court decided not to accept my appeal. So it was not going to get out. It was going to be another 7 years before my first chance to go to the parole board. But in the meantime, the next day, I got a letter from Reformed Theological Seminary saying I was accepted. And the following day, I got a letter from their financial aid department saying I had been given a full scholarship.
Wow.
So, God had answered the prayer, and I knew what he had me to do. And I just focused on my studies and preparing for the ministry God called me to do.
So there are a couple of things left before you get out of prison. You get a call from your lawyer again that says, Mike, what?
This is after I'd gone to the parole board. I went to the parole board the first time. I had 23,000 community service hours. I had 3 college degrees. I had published 2 books. I had no conduct reports. And the parole board gave me 5 more years, which was devastating news. About 4 months later, my lawyer came to see me again out of the blue. And he said, the Ohio Supreme Court overturned your conviction. And I said, that's impossible. I don't have an appeal pending. He said, no, there was a case with the facts just like yours, and the state of Ohio based their appeal on State versus Swiger from the 9th District, and the Supreme Court ruled that that was unconstitutional, the 9th District was wrong, and they overturned my conviction. So less than a year after I was given 5 more years by the parole board, I was released from prison after nearly 17 years.
Tell us what it's like, Mike, for those who are listening right now, can't even visualize at all what it was like. Now, for the third time, you're cleaning out your locker, if you will, taking whatever you have, and you're going home.
Yeah, I just didn't think it was real. And I kept waiting for the other shoe to drop because it had dropped 3 other times.
Yes.
And I remember the day I was released, I was sitting on the edge of my bed waiting for some cataclysmic news to come. And when they yelled my name and opened my door, it was real. They walked me to the back door. So it was a surreal feeling. You know, I had not been in an automobile for almost 2 decades. It was a very strange sensation to be moving at that speed. And the world had changed so dramatically. You know, when I was in prison, they invented the internet. They invented cell phones. And the technology had so far outpaced what I anticipated. It really was walking out of a time capsule into a world I didn't understand. It took me some time to adjust.
Who met you at the airport? Your mom, your dad?
No, my fiance, which is the rest of the story. So I was engaged to be married the day I was arrested in October 1985. I was supposed to be married December 1989. And she waited for me. She waited almost 17 years.
Susan waits almost 17 years.
Yeah, I said that. I never questioned her faithfulness. I only questioned her judgment.
So now you married Susan, and you have 2 beautiful children, a son and a daughter, and your daughter is a special needs child.
She is. Yes. With me, it's always a fascinating story. My wife was 8 months pregnant when she was diagnosed with stage 2 breast cancer. She had a very large mass that was growing rapidly. They induced her to have my daughter early, and my daughter was born with a host of medical complications. She has a very rare chromosomal disorder. She was unable to swallow, had to be fed through a feeding pump directly into her stomach after several surgeries, ended up in the intensive care unit for almost the first 6 months of her life. While she was in the intensive care unit, my wife was going through cancer treatment, and she ended up in the intensive care unit at the same time. And they were in 2 different wings at University Hospital. And I remember praying and said, Lord, I wanted my girls under my roof, not just one roof. Mm-hmm. God walked us through it. My wife has been cancer-free for 10 years. My daughter just turned 11 years old, and she's doing well. She has her challenges, but she is a delightful, loving, beautiful girl who worships her father. So I am blessed by her.
Well, that's one great thing she's learned, that she worships her dad. Mike and I have something in common. My only granddaughter is a special needs child. She's 25 years old. Mike, for parents listening to us right now that have just learned that they have a special needs child, what is it you can pass on to them, Mike?
I really learned the magic of God's blessing on every life. When I first got the news, when my wife was pregnant, though she was having some development complications, and we were older parents because I'd been in prison for so long. We were in our 40s when we conceived my daughter. It's terrifying when you get that kind of news and you don't know what the future holds. But what I've learned with my daughter and with other, I've been around a lot of families now, especially these children, is those children have an infinite capacity to love. They're incredibly accepting and they are a blessing. I know just yesterday, Richard Dawkins, the famous atheist scientist, made a statement. He felt that the world should, by law, eliminate special needs children because they don't contribute to society. And clearly he's never met one, because my daughter has a gift for making everyone feel special and everyone feel loved.
Well, I've met your daughter, and that's exactly right. Mike, during your incarceration, you had an intimately association with everything from men and women, from forgery to murder. What caused you then to say, I want to do something about that?
It went back when I was in the county jail when I first got arrested. You know, I'm looking at the people around me, I'm looking at the case studies they came out of. You know, they brokenness, no parents in the home, no opportunities. And I kept seeing wasted time and wasted capacity and wasted lives. And I saw what I believed to be potential solutions that could be implemented to change this. So shortly after I was released from prison, within the first 6 months, I was in full-time prison ministry, going back to the very prisons I had come from and trying to make a change in this system.
Mike, for the most part, when men and women come out of the prison, I would assume they've lost their contact with their family, their friends. So they have nothing. They don't have clothing. Where am I going to go? They don't have a job, obviously. What happens? What has True Freedom Ministry done for them?
So True Freedom seeks to bridge the gap between release and successful reentry. We provide clothing for guys when they first come home, men and women. We provide cosmetics. We provide job placement. We have a very large, robust reentry program where we place guys in jobs all across Northeast Ohio. We provide transportation to and from work for them. And we seek to build that bridge. Most people, while before they commit crimes outside their homes, have committed crimes inside their homes by robbing their own families and their own siblings, their own parents sometimes, people who are drugged with drugs. So they burn a lot of those bridges, and we seek to bridge that gap with their families until they're able to demonstrate the true change that's taken place in their lives.
You have a clothing store, which kind of blew me away. There were two wonderful stories. Last time I was with you, Mike, I got a chance to see the clothing store. And then, and secondly, I was talking to someone who had been in prison for a long period of time, got out, and you got him a job, and then he didn't have a way to get to the job. You went and picked him up and took him there.
We did. We have four or five vans that we make available to transport people back and forth to work, which is the paradox. You can't get a job unless you have a car, but you can't buy a car unless you have a job. It's difficult to make that leap. Most of us take transportation for granted. Our guys do not. So we provide transportation until they're able to afford their own vehicles. And in the case of the gentleman you're talking about, we will occasionally, for people who are doing all the right things, buy them a car and give them their own independence that way.
Mike, can you put a number on how many men and women that you've helped who have been in prison, have come out of prison, now have a very special relationship with their family? They have a religious association, which they never had before. How many would you think, Mike?
Yeah, prior to COVID, we would have almost 25,000 prisoners attend our services and classes inside the prison system. On the outside, we get about 70 guys a week to come down to our reentry programming. We've placed over 150 guys in jobs. And the gentleman you're talking about, at that one company, we have five different prisoners who had committed murder in the past, who've served over 25 years in prison, who are all working. They're outstanding employees. And they're changing their family's destinies when the change took place inside their heart because of their faith in Jesus Christ.
Where do they go from here? And where do you go from here? I mean, you just mentioned you've saved somewhere right around 25,000 prisoners. What is it that they have learned most from you, Mike Swagger?
Part of it is I'm a living example that if I can make it, they can make it. I go back to the same prisons I did time in. You know, so the guys, there's still people inside of the prison system that I had done time with. And I hear that often, is that just seeing me wear civilian clothes, come and go out the front door, gives sure. them hope, because if God could do it for me, he could do it for them. Where we go from here, True Freedom has been working for the last 18 months on our own transitional housing center, where we can actually provide housing for guys when they get out of prison, if they're unable to find their own housing. The parole board won't send people out to their own address. They have to go to a family member or go to a halfway house. So we're seeking to have our own faith-based halfway house where we could continue building the bridge between correction and reintegration.
It has been a wonder what you've been able to accomplish with them, and not only with them, but what you did for yourself while you were in prison. So now you become a successful writer. Who would have ever guessed? You would have never guessed that.
No, I had never read a novel all the way through until I went to prison. I was never a fiction reader, and I became a fiction writer. So I've enjoyed writing. Two booklets recently that's come out. You've had a big impact on the first one.
Oh, yes.
Is it okay if I share the story of the impact you've had on my life?
Please do, yes.
The first golf outing True Freedom ever had, a mutual friend invited Larry to come to the golf event. And after the event was over, I shared my testimony publicly for the first time. And after I got done speaking, you came over to me and said, "Hello, I'm Larry Morrow." And I said, "I know exactly who you are. I heard your voice on the radio for 30 years. And you said, "I think I can help you. And if you let me help you." I said, I remember that day.
I remember that day vividly, because you came to me right around dinner time and you said, "Larry, would you like to pray for dinner?" And I thought, I don't know if I've ever done that before.
No, and you really blessed us. So we went to breakfast and you had taken notes on my talk. And you said, "Yes, you have a story to tell, but you don't know how to tell it." Yes. "Let me help you." And you shared with me where I should start telling the story and the things that were important to leave in and leave out. And then you came and heard me speak again. You continue to coach me. And I'm sure your listeners don't realize that for 15 years, you've been a personal mentor and a coach to me. You heard me speak hundreds of times. And I'm sorry for my addiction. Coming from Appalachia, I don't have the same sophistication some Scottish people we might know have. But you coached me on how to speak and share my story. And out of that, I had spoke at Wheaton College. The editor from the Daily Bread was there, heard me speak and said, "Would you consider putting that into a book form?" And I said, "I'd be delighted to." So the little booklet that came out, and there's over 50,000 of those in print now, every prison, every state, they're all around the world, is the story you taught me how to tell.
Wow. Well, you've given me much more credit than I deserve. But I will tell you, Mike, that you have become one of Amazon's great writers. And if folks, do me a favor. When you get home, you're listening to this interview in your car. When you get home, I just want you to Google Mike Swiger, and you won't believe what you are about to read. There's a copy of all of his books. Six books, Mike?
Five.
Five books. The sixth one is in his head now. He's probably
reading. I'm working on it.
And I know that our Lord has blessed you greatly. And who would have ever guessed that what got you in prison would then turn out to be a part of your life? And the lives that you have changed simply because of what you have become, Mike. Mike, there was a gentleman whom you had met in prison who turned out to be not only your best friend at the time, but we just lost him recently. Let's just talk briefly about him.
Yeah, Gary Coley. And Gary Coley was a prison minister who came faithfully to the prison I was in for 15 years. He built into my life just a larger-than-life personality and larger-than-life person. He was 6'5", over 400 pounds, had a contagious personality, loved to laugh, filled up the room. And he poured into my life for 15 years. And when I came home, he recruited me to get involved in prison ministry. And he took me back to the prisons I used to go to. Gary was one of the most humble men I've ever met. Just an incredible, funny man who loved the Lord, who had a very dramatic, life-changing experience as well. He had done two numbers in prison, and he went home to be the Lord in January as a result of COVID. It was a very devastating loss. I know he's in glory. I know I'll see him again, but he's the kind of person, and you've met him. You've known him longer than me, actually. has just cannot help but change every life he touches.
Well, what I remember most about Gary was how I met him. And one day, Rosemary and I had just moved into our new home in South Russell. And here's a guy working on the lawn. And I said, "What's your name?" He said, "Gary Coley." And I said to Gary, I said, "What do you do, Gary?" He said, "Well, I just got out of prison." I said, "What were you in prison for?" He said, "Well, for killing a guy." And I thought, could we sit on the porch and make me feel better about all of this? And I remember your line when you wrote something to everyone who had known Gary. Do you remember what it was about heaven?
Your heaven will not be the same. I think that, you know, you probably has already given St. Peter a wedgie, and it's probably already on probation.
Yeah. I can't thank you enough for the time that we've spent together. Thank you, my friend. It's just the beginning of another interview that we'll do it at another time. Okay.
Thank you so very much for having me. It's always a privilege for me to be on the radio with a Hall of Fame radio broadcaster. So thank you.
Larry Morrow's Take Two, heard Saturday morning at 9:30 on 1220 The Word, and Sunday afternoon at 2 on 1420 The Answer. If you have someone you would like us to interview, let me know via email at larry@larrymorrow.com. By the way, if you enjoy Larry Morrow Take Two, check out Larry from the Heart, the radio series airing on 1220 The Word and 1420 The Answer. 90-second stories packed with smiles, designed to make you stop and think about life. And until next time, do all the good you can to everyone you can, every time you can. For Take Two, I'm Larry Morrow.